surface preparation process is developed usually in a product evaluation phase to evaluate how wettable the surface is, and that can begin with a visual inspection to look for any signs of gross contamination. And without quantifying anything, you can visually inspect how easily a drop of water either beads up or fully wets a surface. In general, coatings, paints, and adhesives all wet to a product similar to how water wets a surface. And Bob Willis has a nice video on YouTube describing how to evaluate surface cleanliness through what's called a water break test, which has very similar principles to see how wettable a surface is and if there's any de-wetting present that can indicate the overall state of cleanliness. And another thing to note is it's called the appearance of the solder mask, since it can indicate how difficult it may be for any coating to stick to it.
That's my guest, Dr. Sean Clancy, next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
Dr. Sean Clancy has a Bachelor's of Science in Chemistry from the University of North Florida and a PhD in Chemistry from the University of Southern California. Dr. Sean Clancy has experience in root cause failure analysis of electronic components, wire bonds, epoxy glass fiber composites for bare boards, through-hole technology, and surface mount technology assemblies, as well as soldering, cleaning, conformal coating, and other electronic manufacturing processes for aerospace, automotive, commercial, defense, industrial, medical device, and scientific instrument customers. He has authored 19 publications, including 4 co-authored publications and 2 patent applications, and presented a variety of technical subjects to audiences at local, regional, and international events, including IPC, MRS, SMTA, SPIE, universities, and other venues. Dr. Clancy is Director of Coating Technology at HZO, a manufacturer of coating equipment and a provider of various coating services, including paraline coatings, plasma-applied nano coatings, plasma-enhanced paraline, multi-layer material coating applications, atomic layer deposition, hybrid coatings, and more. Here's my conversation with Dr. Sean Clancy about all things coating. Sean Clancy, welcome to Reliability Matters. I appreciate you being my guest today.
Hi, Mike. It's my pleasure to be your guest today.
Before we dive into conformal coating and coatings in general, let's talk a little bit about your company, HZO. Tell me about the origins of the company and the market, the markets that it serves, and the types of general products that it produces.
So as technology evolves, products and devices, especially consumer electronics, get smaller, more complex, and more portable. And with this new mobility and device complexity comes never before experienced exposure to a wider variety of environments. And this can include rain, sweat, sea air, corrosive gases, and more, which threaten the sensitive electronics inside these expensive and necessary devices. So we recognize that the available protection options, things like seals, gaskets, heavy and thick conformal coatings, had significant drawbacks, especially for this new generation of electronics. So we developed the HZO Spectrum of Protection, which is a portfolio of thin film conformal coatings and nano coatings, specifically engineered to protect today's and tomorrow's electronic products. And this spectrum of protection was designed to be applied during the manufacturing process, enabling the specific protection any given device and company required. And since our founding in 2011, HZO has been protecting electronics around the world from the most demanding environments with superior nano coatings. This is accomplished through custom tailored solutions to meet customer requirements in every field, from consumer electronics to IoT, automotive to health, and others, to deliver a better, more reliable, water-resistant, and waterproof product. And our For our customers, this reduces costly returns and improves customer satisfaction and retention. We're protecting electronic devices from the inside out, regardless of the environment.
So, Sean, as I see it, there are two methods of preventing water or whatever other bad actors from damaging the product. Either build a wall, encase the subject product in a fortress and not allow material to get in, or just concede that we're going to lose that battle over time and know that bad actors are going to get in and protect the actual target, protect the sensitive product. Are there advantages or disadvantages, pros and cons to either of those methods?
I think there's both advantages and disadvantages. The first strategy of presenting the undesirable material from entering the product usually involves gaskets. So historically, gaskets have worked reasonably well for some products, mainly through the design of the product's enclosure or housing, and they can be relatively cheap. There are a few downsides to gaskets in that they can pop up, including gaskets becoming dislodged, swelling, or breaking when the product's housing undergoes any type of mechanical, chemical, or thermal stress, such as when the product is dropped, exposed to incompatible solvents, or even with the thermal cycling of repeated hot, cold extremes. Eventually, the gasket will fail, and then the components inside are prone to whatever gets through the breach. So gasket-sealed products also have to account for any inherent pressure differentials with either relative humidity, water immersion, corrosive gases, etc. So nature's driving towards equilibrium. So when you have a pressure difference, gas or liquids want to push through from a high to a low level until both sides are equal. So with water, other corrosives can then be trapped inside a housing that uses gaskets at that point and start corroding the electronics. And with the second strategy is coating the circuit assemblies inside the product with a protective coating. With this method, it's not as much of an issue when water or other materials get in the product's housing, since the assemblies inside are protected with a strong barrier coating. Some housing designs can even allow water to move in and out easily to prevent a pressure gradient from forming and then allow for any corrosive materials to drain away more easily. So when planning for protective coatings, you have to consider where you want the coating to be or not be, which is generally handled through masking and demasking processes. And also you should consider how and where your customers will use the product, what temperatures it'll experience, how much direct sunlight, does it need to be halogen-free, and et cetera.
One anecdote, just the other day, I was in my pool, and I have the most recent iPhone. I'm just, I'm a technology geek, so I'm not the guy that stands in line, but I pre-order. That particular model, the iPhone 11 Max Pro Turbo, whatever they call it, it has a water rating, a water resistance rating. So it can supposedly go down to 30 feet for a few minutes and be okay. The interesting thing is I never have dropped it in the water, but sometimes it sits close to the edge of the pool and the grandkids come over and they splash and sometimes it gets wet. Every time that happens, I can't charge my phone for a good 10 hours because when I plug in the charging cable, it says there's moisture detected in the charging cable that could hurt your phone. So we're not going to let you charge it until it's completely gone. So yes, it can survive a drop in the water, but clearly their approach, at least to that part of the phone, was to allow ingress of fluids and just, through software, just shut off a certain feature of the phone, charging. So not quite as water resistant as I had hoped. I guess it's enough to prevent me from having to buy a new phone, but it's not enough where the phone will continue to function properly if it's subjected to moisture, at least for a period of time. It's almost like a timeout, you know. So it's not quite as waterproof as one thinks from that standpoint. So let's talk about, you talked about different types of coatings. You used the term thin film and nano coating. Let's walk me through the different types of coatings. We'll get into the actual materials like acrylics and perolines and stuff in a moment. But in terms of the basic like application methods or types, tell me the difference between a thin film and a nano coating, which to me is like an ultra thin film, and a regular everyday type conformal coating material. What are the differences? What types of products are they used for?
The differences are that the traditional and the nano coatings is a combination of thickness, as the term nano implies, nanometer scale thickness, as well as material selection, its deposition method, and cure mechanism. And for traditional conformal coatings, its thicknesses, let's say, ranging from 25 microns or a mil to even hundreds of microns or even millimeters in some cases. And those include acrylics, epoxies, silicones, urethanes, and which can be deposited through spray dip, dispense, and selective dispense. And those are cured through ambient moisture, heat, UV light, or a combination of all these. And since they start out as liquids, they're dispersed in a solvent. The overall thickness of the coating is dependent upon its viscosity, how concentrated it is, and how fast material can cure. So generally, gravity pulls the coating down and leaves thinner coverage at the top of the component leads, on sidewalls, and other tall features. And so traditional coatings have solvents and exposure hazards that need to be managed, and those curing processes can range from seconds for like UV cure, or for like moisture cure, things can take up to weeks to achieve a full cure. So you need to plan on managing, you know, floor space, proper environmental conditions, and how to handle these products in the work in progress stage. Perolines can be deposited in thicknesses ranging from nanometers to 50 microns, potentially even more. IPC mil, NASA specs call for thicknesses ranging from 12.5 to up to 50 microns. But compared to traditional coatings, perolines are deposited through what's called a chemical vapor deposition, or CVD, polymerization process, where products is placed in a deposition chamber, and the perolene precursor material, which most of the time is called a dimer, is a powder that's loaded into another part of the system called a vaporizer or sublimer, and the whole system is pumped down under vacuum. Dimer is then heated and sublimes from a solid to a gas, and is pulled by the vacuum through a heated zone called a pyrolyzer or pyro. And that pyro cracks or splits the dimer into two active monomers that enter the deposition chamber, which is around room temperature and coats everything in the chamber. So the good thing about perolene is that it coats everything. The challenging thing about perolene is that it coats everything. So for perolene and other low vacuum CVD coatings, buttons, switches, and even the masking agents you use need to be able to handle the vacuum process. And for nearly all coating types, you have to mask connectors, test points, and grounding pads to allow for the easy removal of that dielectric coating and allow for electrical conductivity and connectivity. And these masks can include a plug, cap, tape, glue, etc., to cover areas where you don't want the coating to stay. And after the coating process, the masking material along with the coating in that area is removed altogether. So we've developed methods to use to remove perolene from the unmasked areas, either use plasma ashing or etching processes, laser ablation, or a combination of the two. These methods are dependent on product design and may require customization for certain applications and production volumes. And besides depositing perylene in the nanometer range, we're also developing plasma polymer, ALD, and other types of coatings that have target thicknesses well under a micron. So depending on the connector type, the level of protection required, the product design, masking may not be required for coatings in that thickness range and may be considered what's called connect through.
So, you talk about the different types of coatings from acrylics up to perylenes and the application methods. You also mentioned viscosity. So viscosity, I guess, serves, both as a nemesis and as an advantage to a process. I'm not an expert, obviously, on conformal coating, which is why you're on that end of the microphone and I'm on this end. But the from common sense would tell me that if you have too high a viscosity, you'll get thicker coatings at the top. Gravity has slightly less effect, but you may not get underneath the component or completely sealed down at the lower areas. And if you have too low a viscosity, then you'll have really thin layers at the top and thicker layers at the bottom. Is that a correct assessment?
Yes.
So perylene, due to its application method, it's not sprayed on, as you mentioned. Does that give someone more control over a uniform thickness?
Yes, it coats everywhere evenly.
Okay.
I mean, there might be very slight differences depending on if you're inhibiting like gas flow and things like that, but it will wrap around every part to very close to the same thickness everywhere in the chamber. Mm-hmm.
So, Sean, this may be an ignorant question here, but I've always wondered this. When a circuit assembly is coated, is there any effect on heat dissipation, particularly if this assembly runs hot? Does that provide any advantage, disadvantage? What are the thermal transfer rate differences between an uncoated board and a coated board?
There can be minor differences, especially with the very thin coatings. It's much more of a problem when you get to thicker coatings and things that are form both dielectric and thermal barriers. But typically for the thinner coatings in the terms of microns or even sometimes up to tens of microns, it may not be an issue at all.
You and I both have been over the years to the Cleaning and Coating Conference, which is a joint production between IPC and SMTA, and it every 2 years in the Chicago area. And the very first one, which was, I don't know, 8 or 10 years ago, there's all these speakers talking about cleaning and coating and all the best practices to get the coating to stay on the assembly and a lot of things that we're talking about here. And then I think we had an expert panel come up and there were questions asked and answered. And then someone asked, how do you remove conformal coating? And that totally took over the whole conversation. That became the most popular question in 3 days of how to put it on was this one guy that went, well, what if we need to take it off? And what was apparent way back then was there wasn't a lot of good solutions presented. It was basically, put it in this really toxic chemical and have it dissolve, or put it in a sandblasting machine and micro abrasion it off. And both seemed very prehistoric in terms of their methods compared to all the technology about applying it. Taking it off seemed very prehistoric. So tell me about conformal coating removal or coating removal in general. Has that progressed? Has that become easier and a little less prehistoric over the last several years?
I would say yes, it has become less prehistoric, but still people like to say that perylenes are impossible to rework. And that's just not true. It does have excellent chemical resistance, so I agree you can't use the solvent method you described to dissolve it and strip it off, but you can remove it using microblast abrasion, which you just mentioned. And that can include a variety of blast media, even crushed dry ice. So if you want to use crushed dry ice, you just have to be careful around any components that are sensitive to thermal shock. And a skilled assembler or rework specialist can perform this with a manual system, and automated systems, I believe, are available as well. And you can remove it, perylenes through laser ablation systems at a variety of wavelengths and types, including excimer and CO2 lasers. Even CO2 lasers found in the laser cutting and etching tools that are available for what's called maker use can work well. One of the major efforts in that technique, though, is ensuring that you've aligned the laser over the appropriate areas. So it's good to have an automated optical inspection like visual system in place. And laser ablation works best on flat surfaces such as ground pads and test points. And another technique is called plasma ashing or etching. Here you have areas on your assemblies where you want to remove the coating exposed to a plasma composed of oxygen or a combination of gases. And over time, the plasma exposed areas cause the coating to etch away. And plasma ashing can work for flat and three-dimensional features, including ground pads, shield cans, and many types of connectors. I'd like to say, though, that many nanometer thick coatings can just be soldered through. So there are opportunities for desoldering a component, resoldering it, cleaning or preparing the area, and just recoating.
Excellent. So it sounds like we have left the prehistoric age and come into modern time with laser and other more automated versions of that, laser plasma, things like that. Excellent. Well, I'm glad to hear that, we don't need the hammer and chisel, to take the material off. I guess that's the challenge of perylene. It is so well known for adherence or adhesion, I should say, that you spend all your effort convincing people how good it is for adhesion and how robust it is to protect against harsh environments. And that goes against you when you have to rework it, right? It can't be right. That. You can't say, oh, no, just peel it off. So you can't have both. But I guess the more important attribute is not removal. The more important attribute is that it stays in place and protects. If I were to have only one attribute to choose from, it would have to be that, not removal.
Right. I mean, the rework process is important for like the aerospace defense type boards that might cost upwards of 10 grand or more per board, or you have a specialized processor that might be, 3 to 5K on it or something. So right. If you want to replace that or replace something else on the board, then rework is very important.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's all a matter of cost and availability, particularly on those old military boards where a lot of those boards are obsolete and they're only repaired. They're not made anymore. There are contract manufacturers and OEMs that do their own conformal coating in-house. I've seen it. You know when you're getting near that part of the assembly process because you can smell it. It's pretty nauseous. Is perylene coating more typically done through a perylene coating contractor, or is it frequently or seldom done on the factory floor at the OEM or the contract manufacturer?
We've actually had the most experience being installed at the contract manufacturer. And we have several different, let's say, business models / methods of how the customer wants to interact with the coating process. So either we can behave similar to a contract coater where you send your parts off, coat, and we ship them back. But the most products that we've coat have been had the systems installed somewhere in the contract manufacturer's facility. And so after the boards come off the reflow line, they get hand it off to us. We mask, coat, demask, inspect, and hand it back to the contract manufacturer to finish the final assembly.
In a paralleling world, I talked about in the spray application, you have to have really good air ventilation because the smell is pretty severe. In a paralleling world, because this process is done inside of a chamber, is the odor a little bit more controlled?
There's practically no odor. I mean, there is a exhaust connection for the systems, and that's mainly because the vacuum pumps themselves are vented and out of the building. But there's very little, if any, smell associated with the process.
Yeah, that's good. So in our world, in the cleaning world, you know, we clean two things. We clean circuit assemblies post reflow, and we clean stencils that are used to apply the solder paste to the bare board. And the stencils require cleaning, two types of cleaning. They require usually in-process cleaning, which is just an underwipe in the stencil printer machine. And when the production run is done, the stencils are taken offline and cleaned in a stencil cleaner or manually cleaned. There's been a lot of talk about nano coatings on stencils that can either be applied by the stencil manufacturer or reapplied by the stencil owner in use. What types of advantages do nano coatings provide on stencils? And is it a gimmick? Is it real? Does it wear off because stencils are cleaned all the time? Does that affect the nano coating? Do you have any experience in that particular segment of the market?
I've read up on that, and most of the coatings are reasonably robust. It really depends on the coating, but the whole point is to help make sure you have the solder paste go through the apertures in the stencil and release the way you want it to, so you don't have any blockages and continuous or good solder paste transfer over many assemblies. Mm-hmm. And there are coatings that can withstand the whole wipe process for, I don't know, I would probably say several hours or to days, but I've read up on, there are some products that claim to last for weeks to months. It's just a lot of how, let's say, both managing hydrophobic, oleophobic, and wear resistant or abrasion resistant those coatings are.
Here's another anecdote. I was, every once in a while I get my car detailed. They come to my office and my detailer offered me a special package. It was $1,500. And he promised me that the car would not need another detail for 3 years, just a wash here and there. And which made me understand why he wants to charge me so much, because he's not going to be back for a while. And right. He was not knowing what industry I'm in. He was explaining the marvels of this brand new scientific achievement in car waxes called nano coating. And he would apply a special nano coating, which is super expensive, hence $1,500. You know, all these advantages of this nano coating. And then, so I chuckled a little bit and I said, no, thanks. That's fine. Just regular detail. Thank you. And then the next time I went to the auto supply store for something, I saw like turtle wax with nano coating and all these different brand MacGyvers with nano coating. And, you know, it's almost become a, in the consumer world anyway, it's just kind of become a fancy name. You know, I don't really understand if there's truly a nano coating technology in those consumer products, or if it's just one molecule of something so they could say it's there. But in the real world of nano coating, I would assume that a nano coating is used when a traditional other type of coating material would be too thick, or if a material is maybe pliable Is that where nanocoatings kind of have their advantage?
Yes, it's more where you want to have either water wick or roll away, or if you need an oxygen barrier along with just blocking water ingress. And you can even coat devices at different stages, such as at the component level, bare board, or full assemblies. It really depends on what you want to achieve, and especially for legacy products, what failure modes were most common, which can help direct which protection methods work best to improve reliability and, in turn, customer satisfaction.
One of your customers was Nike, it talked about on your website.
HCO was with Nike when they launched the Fuel Band wearable.
Back to electronics.
Most of the products we have been related to circuit assemblies and related devices, but we're branching out to other applications as well. Besides some wearables, we coat e-readers, tablets, earbuds, headphones, ruggedizing tablets. We've also coated things like concussion sensors and fall detectors, smart home devices, and LED displays and billboards as well.
Yeah, very good. Back to the subject of IoT, people in my audience has heard me kind of rail kind of against this whole concept of IoT, which is, you know, connecting to consumer devices just because we can, not because there's a market for it. And the example I always give is like the connected toothbrush, which is a real thing. Your toothbrush can be connected to your Wi-Fi, which could tell the parent of little Susie or Johnny is brushing their teeth for how long, how vigorous, et cetera. But the expansion of IoT, and I'm a geek, so I do enjoy all these, these connected electrified devices. But one of the things about cheap consumer devices now being able to connect to the internet means that we're taking these kind of low-cost class one devices and throwing them into harsh environments. Wearables are that way. Even if it's just a little light-up button that you can pin to your jacket, there's electronics in there. And it's not a class three device. Nobody dies if they fail. But the products are now coming with us because we use IoT and we take it with us, or we take it outside. And I see now a lot of failures because it's not a class three device. They're generally not cleaning. It's usually no clean. It probably isn't coated or coated well. Usually it's just, ingress protection. And these devices are failing. And it's a harsh environment world out there, and circuit boards don't like harsh environments. So I do see how IoT is potentially increasing the coating industry's business, because without proper coating, that stuff just doesn't survive when it's attached to a human or follows a human around. We go to scary places. So I think that's certainly a challenge that the industry has to solve, which is to be able to take kind of low cost class one type devices and still make them reliable, not to save lives, but just, to save reputation and replacement costs. And part of the success of any conformal coating is surface preparation. I don't know if you, I think I might be older than you, but there was a car painting establishment, I think they're still around, called Earl Scheib. You heard of them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So back when I was a kid, there were television commercials that where Earl Scheib would stand in front of the camera and say, "I'll paint any car for $29.95. And even back then, that was cheap, right? So it's like, how can you possibly paint an entire car for less than $30? And the joke was that, if you picked the wrong color and you had buyer's remorse, don't worry, because within 3 months, the paint's all going to peel off anyway. Because for $30, you wash your own car, bring it in clean. There was no surface preparation at all. Any coating, any painting, any adhesion process requires good surface preparation. What type of advice do you give to your customers when they want you to coat something, or they want to purchase your equipment to coat something? What's the best practice? Let's go back to electronic assemblies. What's the best practice for surface preparation?
Well, there's a couple different ways to go about it. So surface preparation process is developed usually in a product evaluation phase to evaluate how wettable the surface is. And that can begin with a visual inspection to look for any signs of gross contamination. And without quantifying anything, you can visually inspect how easily a drop of water either beads up or fully wets a surface. In general, coatings, paints, and adhesives all wet to a product similar to how water wets a surface. And Bob Willis has a nice video on YouTube describing how to evaluate surface cleanliness through what's called a water break test, which has very similar principles to see how wettable a surface is and if there's any de-wetting present that can indicate the overall state of cleanliness. And another thing to note is it's called the appearance of the solder mask, since it can indicate how difficult it may be for any coating to stick to it. The shinier the solder mask, it usually means it's glassier and smoother. And this is great for preventing flux and flux residue from bridging when they're used in adequate amounts, but can be problematic when you want to use it something after soldering to have it stick to it. In contrast, matte solder masks are usually easier to adhere to. And plasma treatment with argon and oxygen can improve wettability by introducing micro roughness with the argon, and oxygen can provide a small amount of oxidation to add chemical groups to bond to. And I've heard of some cases in industry where plasma treatment wasn't able to improve the excessively cured or glassy solder masks. So those assemblies had to be scrapped, and either another solder mask had to be specified, or the bare board manufacturer had to modify their solder mask cure process.
With plasma treatment, it's kind of like a microscopic chemical Velcro. You're really creating a rough surface so that the coating material digs in a little bit and digs under the pores and the micro little craters created by roughing up the surface, right?
Correct. And the more hydrophobic the surface is prior to coating, the more difficult it will be for items to stick to it. So you can quantify the surface energy by using either dime pens for estimating surface energy ranges or using a water contact angle measurement tool to see if the surface is hydrophilic or water loving, and it means it has an angle below 90 degrees, mm-hmm. or hydrophobic, which means water fearing and has an angle above 90 degrees. So both methods use the same principles. So the dime pens have inks with a range of surface energies where you swipe the pen across the surface and you observe the ink to see if it stays as a coherent stripe or if it starts beading up. And the contact angle tool is usually a camera, light source, and a flat surface between the two. And you use a syringe to drop a small drop of water or other fluid on there. And you focus on the drop of water and essentially take a photo. And then you use the software to measure the angle on the sides of the water droplet to see if it's hydrophilic or hydrophobic.
Yeah, one of our prior guests on this show worked for BTG Labs, and they make a handheld, kind of a large gun-shaped device that will do contact angle measurement kind of right there on the fly on various products to measure the surface energy of the product. But I know those things can also be done manually with dime pens and things like that. For some people, they think there may be an advantage in having it more automated so that the tests are more repeatable and less subjective, and others have no problem having their people do it manually and interpret the results themselves. I guess it all depends on budget and quantity and things like that, but as a general rule, I think you're right, the cleaner the product, the more adherable the surface will be. Is there any advantage to different coating materials in terms of cleanliness requirements? Does Parylene, because it's applied in a machine under vacuum, does that give you a little bit of a pass in terms of cleanliness, or does it do all surfaces need to be just as clean regardless of what type of coating material is going to be applied?
It really depends on how clean and reliable and robust your product needs to be in the long run. For any coating, it's ideal that you start with a clean, dry surface and that the boards are kept dry before coating, and adhesion and long-term performance can be enhanced with plasma treatment and the use of primers. But really, you should, if you have your process tightly controlled all the way, you know, back to component selection, solder paste application, reflow, and general state of cleanliness, it's beneficial to all parties, customer, CM, coder, and even end user. And even if cleaning isn't an option and you absolutely have to use a no clean process, then minimizing the amount of flux residue and any other handling contamination can be acceptable for general use or consumer electronic devices. We've had a lot of good performance with just our general processes of ensuring good surface prep and perylene and not having to do a full clean.
Yeah, I think cleaning is best practice, but it's not always possible. And so one of the bits of advice we give to our customers, now, you know, we live in a cleaning world, so we're like, you know, Maslow's law, you know, if all you have is a hammer, the whole world is a bed of nails. You know, we see everything as contamination. But the reality is some people just don't want to or can't clean prior to coating. So we tell them to bake. You mentioned dry. What a lot of people don't realize is when you're, you know, they think when they coat, they're sealing out, you know, harmful things. Right. But they are also sealing in potentially harmful things. So, you know, I had experience, my audience has heard this story probably too many times, but I was hired as an expert witness in a civil lawsuit between an OEM and a contract manufacturer. And basically the OEM sued the contract manufacturer by doing exactly what the OEM said to do. And when the product failed, they said, well, you should have known that we were wrong. You know, so, but one of the things they were doing was not coating technically. I guess technically it's coating. They were encasing their product in silicone, probably about an inch of silicone all the way around, and then throwing these products into the ground. And they ran the products off a battery, a 10-year battery, which turned out to be a 6-month battery, because they had a lot of electrical leakage. They had CAF, which is a subterranean ECM issue between the layers of the board, and they also had dendritic growth and parasitic leakage on the surface of the board. And they couldn't figure out why, because they had not only coated the board, they had put it in this completely protective surrounding of silicone. And, you know, it turns out they didn't clean, you know, mistake number one, but the biggest mistake is they didn't bake. So they had all the ingredients for electrochemical migration already within the package. And had they not coated it, one can argue that moisture may have outgassed and you know, not caused the problems that they actually experienced. But so I think when people ask me, should I clean? Of course, yes. But also consider you're not cleaning just for adhesion. You're also cleaning to make sure that you're not trapping in all the ingredients that are required for electrochemical migration failure mechanisms to occur. Because we are trapping in all the bad actors, and it's good to get the bad actors off the island before we coat the island. You know, I think that's the advice that we give. If someone says, okay, HCO, I want to either buy your products or have you coat stuff for me, what types of questions do you ask, or what types of questions do you recommend your customers ask when considering a coating process?
Generally, they should ask about the experience the supplier has with that type of product and how it will be used. They should ask about the scalability of their coating process and if they can meet the expected number of samples that need to be coated with the desired throughput, either per day, per week, per month, etc. The supplier will likely ask the customer about the design and complexity of their product, which would need to be evaluated for the number and type of, it's called coating keep out regions or masking points, which can include connectors, test points, ground pads, etc. And the supplier will also need to know the expected in-use environment, the level of protection required, whether the customer only needs coating or if they required a solution that involves masking, coating, and demasking.
Excellent. Let's kind of end on this kind of negative note. I find that when we talk about best practices, people listen. When we talk about common mistakes, more people listen. Everyone likes, you know, misery loves company. What are, in your experience in this industry, what are some of the classic mistakes that you've seen people make when coding or considering coding? And any good, you know, horror stories from the field? No names. We don't want you to lose customers. But, well, let me back up a little bit. One of my favorite things is back in the day when we could travel and we were going to trade shows and things like that, you know, back in the normal days, quite frequently after the show, we'll go out to dinner and end up in a bar and we'll talk to, you know, all the other people in our industry. We'll kind of gather around and we all compare stories like these, you know, the horror stories. And everyone has a better story than the next guy. And and we commiserate with that. I'll start with this story. One of the products we make are ionic contamination testers, ROSE testers, which basically have this super, super, super clean extraction solution, 150 million ohm electrical resistance in the solution. And the board is put into this solution, and the board is dirtier than the solution, so contaminants, residues are extracted from the board, and that changes the electrical resistivity of the test solution. So the resistivity starts to drop, and then we determine from that amount of the drop and other things how dirty the board was. So we had a customer, this is way back probably 30 years ago, 25, 28 years ago, somewhere around there, where we were a young company. You know, I was doing like everything, chief cook and bottle washer. So I had a customer that said, you know, our boards are all failing. It was a big military contract and our boards are all failing. And I flew to Florida, which is where they were, to witness the process, because we couldn't figure out what was wrong by diagnosing it over the phone. So I said, just run a test. Show me. I just want to see. I want to be a fly on the wall. Show me. I'm not going to get involved. I just want to see you run a test, because I couldn't find anything wrong with the machine. So he's ready to, he's cleaned the board. Now he's ready to test it. And the tank is of extraction solutions about 18 inches deep. And his board was only about 4 by 4 inches. So he didn't want to drop the board from the top of the tank down to the bottom. So all of a sudden I see him unbuttoning his sleeve and slowly rolling the sleeve up his arm. And I'm thinking, no. I just flew 3,000 miles. No. And of course he puts his arm holding the board all the way down to the bottom of the test cell, lets the board go, takes his arm off, shakes the test solution off his arm, and runs the test. And his employees were all standing around. So I'm like, oh no, how do you tell this guy he's wrong in front of all his staff, you know, tactfully. So anyway, we just did it. And I said, oh, we know how clean your arm is. You know, your arm doesn't pass, you know, mill standard cleanliness at the time. So that was one of my favorite stories. Anything hit your desk where your engineers come up to you and go, hey, Sean, we can't figure this out. Help us out here. Here's what this guy's doing.
Well, I would say in general, the most common mistakes when is expecting a coating to undo your past mistakes. So applying a coating to a product can make a difference in the long-term reliability and usability, but it's not the first line of defense. And the first step in preventing reliability issues is making sure that your product has been properly designed, stored, and cleaned before a coating is even considered. In other words, you shouldn't assume that a coating would cover a multitude of sins.
Coating makes sure the process doesn't get any worse, or the results don't get any worse. It doesn't make it better.
Right. And it's like you mentioned with the silicone potting product, silicone is decent, or depends on the silicone, but they're decent at blocking out bulk water, but like molecular water can get through silicones reasonably quickly, and you can end up having a puddle under your coating, you know, in short time. So if you have any of ionic residues or anything on your board before potting, you're going to end up having dendritic failure. And years ago, when I worked at the EMPF, where I believe we first met.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
I did a lot of failure analysis work. And one of the products that came in was a sensor from an oil rig out in the ocean. And they said, oh, this display burned out and failed. You know, what's going on? And you start looking at it. And, oh, it's like, oh, it's got a coating on it. And start looking behind on the backside of the board. There's like the coating is delaminating everywhere. I see a partial fingerprint. There's dendritic growth between most of the pins. And it's just like, so if I had access to CODIS, I could tell you who touched the board before coding.
My favorite thing about the EMPF was Jim Raby and his beloved 6336, you know, weapons standard, weapons spec. And the line where he would say, this is the way you have to do it. And if you do it any other way, it's subject to review and disapproval. Those were actually the words that were in the standard. So it's like, hey, yeah, no problem. Yeah, you come up with a better idea, but it's subject to disapproval. So I used to really enjoy that. Yeah, the EMPF was a real valuable tool for manufacturers of equipment to get a very unbiased and very tough review of your products. It wasn't enough to say what they did. You had to provide products, send them into the desert, and have them actually reviewed by probably folks like yourself, you know, who knew what they were doing. The current EMPF in Philadelphia, I think or whatever they call themselves now, a little bit different. I think they still do a lot of good work there, but it certainly doesn't compare to the days when connected to China Lake and California in the desert, and really had a lot of clout back in those days.
Yeah, I worked at one there in Philadelphia, and I came to them though after I did my postdoc at China Lake.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you got to serve your time in the desert, so quite literally in this case, right?
Oh, I hardly ever went over 120 back then.
I know, right? Just the other day, Death Valley, which is kind of near there, was 130 degrees, hottest place on earth, set a record.
And yeah.
You think about it, 100 degrees is awfully hot. That's 30 degrees higher than that. That's crazy. But that's why they call it Death Valley. That's why it's a desert, right?
Well, yeah. And I remember, you know, leaving the buildings, going to the parking lot, and it's like, oh, it's 100 degrees. I can handle this. And it's 110. This isn't great. Then it's 120. You better get to the car quick. And
get to the car, turn on the air conditioner, go to the mall, whatever it takes.
Yeah. Get the windows down so you don't bake in the car.
Yeah. 120 outside is like almost 200 inside. So, yeah. Sean, thank you very much for being my guest. You're a resource of information. I really appreciate it. If someone wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way?
You can reach me at HCO, either through email or just calling HCO's main numbers.
Excellent. And for our listeners, I will have Sean's contact information, phone number, email in the show notes. So you can go to Spreaker, Spreaker.com under Reliability Matters and look at the episode for Sean. And we will have that information right there. So Sean, thanks again for being my guest. You're a wealth of knowledge. And I appreciate all the information you're providing. And I wish you safety and health as we move forward through this pandemic. Hopefully we're closer to the end of it than we are the beginning of it.
Thank you, Mike. I enjoyed speaking with you today, too.
All right. Take care, Sean.
You too.
Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. A special thanks to Circuits Assembly Magazine and Ascendo Reliability for syndicating this show, and where you can listen to this and other interesting podcasts on PCBChat.com and Reliability.fm. Thanks for your questions and episode suggestions. Please keep them coming. Send comments to mike@mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Reliability Matters. Once again, thanks for listening and keep doing it right.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.